This is Payne. This is Del Sol.
My name is Ellen Del Sol, and I represent the United States. The question presented in this case is whether a tax form submitted after the IRS has already assessed tax is a return for purposes of bankruptcy code.
Well, I must be here somewhere, but I wasn't clear what he owes and what his income is.
I believe for the year issue of 1986, his income was approximately $155,000. And the amount assessed was approximately $64,000. Just a minute, I can.
Yeah, but there's been withholding, right?
There was withholding of about $44,000, and the total amount assessed was $64,472 plus interest and penalties.
So what, $10,000?
So the actual tax due, yes, was about $20,000, Your Honor.
How much?
$20,000. I believe the amount withheld was $44,000.
In these other years, they haven't been, we don't know what he owes for those years or what his income is.
I don't believe that's in the record, Your Honor.
So he owed $20,000 and offered you $1,000, is that right?
That is correct. But that's not really relevant to the analysis here.
I'm just curious.
The other three courts of appeal to address this issue have held is that when a tax form is not submitted until after assessment, when the debtor lets the IRS go through.
But just one more question. So, in the record of this case, did he offer an excuse for why he waited for the assessment to file the return?
I don't believe there's any excuse whatsoever.
It's not in the record.
Your Honor.
Okay, thanks.
And if the reason that this particular year was assessed was because the IRS didn't think he had filed a return at all, right?
Well, initially, the IRS didn't think. There were two issues in this case.
And that's why we argued the assessment.
And, that's not the only reason why the IRS made the assessment. It's been the IRS position in numerous cases, three of which have been decided, three different courts of appeals have been decided raising this issue. It's the IRS's position that if a tax form is not filed before assessment, it's not a return within the meaning of the tax law definition in Beard, which all the courts of appeals have applied in interpreting what return means for purposes of the section that's issued.
What are the consequences of whether something is a return? Not just in bankruptcy law, what other consequences are there?
Well, I think in the tax law generally, whether something is a return, there are a number of sections that use the term return that gives the taxpayer rights, benefits, limits on liability with respect to having filed a valid return. If the taxpayer files a return, he has the benefit of there being a time limit on the time the government has to assess tax. He has the benefit of not having to pay penalties for failure to file a return. There may be others in the tax code, but I don't have a list in front of me. But
of course, there are detriments. If you lie on your return, you are guilty of a federal crime.
That is true, Your Honor. But I think there is.
Suppose Mr. Payne had lied on this document in an effort to throw the IRS off the scent. He had misrepresented his income, exaggerated his deductions. Would he have been punished for doing that?
I think there are two, the answer to that in short is yes.
There are two possible answers to my question, yes and no. Could he have been punished or not?
Yes, sir.
And why?
Well, under tax law, there are a certain set of laws that deal with just simply requirements of filing returns, which Mr. Payne didn't comply with. And then there's a separate section of the tax law that deals with fraudulent returns, where there's actually an outright...
See, the reason I'm asking this question is that this is either a return or it isn't. If it is a return, then it has certain consequences in a bankruptcy case, and if there's fraud on it, you could prosecute for filing a fraudulent return. If it's not a return, it has certain consequences in a bankruptcy case, and you can't prosecute for filing a fraudulent return. But I'm puzzled about your answer, which is, seems to be that it's not a return for purposes of bankruptcy law, but it is a return for any purpose that would benefit the IRS.
Well, I think that's the one.
Just hold on, counsel. This is not the Price is Right. There's no benefit for trying to see if you can give an answer before I'm done. But the reason why I'm asking this question is because since there's no definition of return in the bankruptcy code, the only definition comes from the tax code. It's going to be a return for all purposes or for no purposes. I don't see how bankruptcy law can play a role. And I don't see how there can be two definitions of the word return. So that's, essentially you can give up and say it's not a return for any purpose, including those that benefit the IRS. Puzzles me is your effort to say it's a return for all purposes that benefit the IRS and no purposes that benefit the taxpayer.
Well, I think that's how the law has evolved, Your Honor. Under the Beard test,
under what has the law evolved that way? It's not because of the definition of the bankruptcy code. We agree there is none.
Well, there is no definition spelled out in the tax code.
Exactly.
And if
you're relying on Beard doesn't depend on the purpose. It doesn't depend on gains or losses from the definition.
Well, it does depend on being an honest and reasonable attempt to comply with the tax law, and every other court of appeals...
Yes, and if it's not, you tell us that Mr. Payne's document is not such a thing, and therefore, if you lie a blue streak on it, one would think your answer has to be, no, it's still not a return, and indeed, if you lied on it, a blue streak, you need even less an honest and reasonable attempt to comply with the tax laws, because the more lies, the less honest and reasonable it is, and therefore the more lies he tells, the less the IRS can do to prosecute him.
Well, in the Bob Rocker case, the Supreme Court addressed this issue of fraudulent returns, and the taxpayer made the argument that because it was not honest and reasonable, which is the test, derived in the Zellerbach and Germantown Trust cases and then adopted in the Beard case, that therefore it must be a nullity, so he should get out of all the penalties associated with a fraudulent return. And without ignoring all that law about what's a return for all the sections that deal with rights and the requirement of filing a return, the court said, we're not going to say that he can get out of the tax laws by saying that there was no return because it was fraudulent. And if fraudulent return embodies one inquiry under the Badaracco line of reasoning, and another inquiry is whether it's a return for purposes of all the provisions in the tax code that require filing a valid return. And I think that concept is what overlies this bankruptcy definition here. And I think to rule otherwise would be contrary to the ruling of three other courts of appeals and would upset a large body of tax law.
What you're really arguing is that to avoid absurd results, either in the tax code or either in tax fraud cases or in bankruptcy cases, you will have to define return differently on the two settings, right? You're saying context affects meaning.
I think that you do have to look at the difference in the context, because the fraudulent return sections are all things that an honest attempt to comply with the law has not been made, but yet they use these words fraudulent return and imposing all the penalties for a fraudulent return. And when the taxpayer does nothing and doesn't comply with the return requirements, that same taxpayer cannot be said to have filed a return within the meaning of the tax law. And I think to rule otherwise would upset a whole body of tax law that assumes that tax returns are not just a piece of paper. They have a purpose of helping with our system of self-assessment, and they have to be an honest attempt to comply with the law that furthers that self-assessment goal. The Supreme Court, in several cases, the Wayne Walls case and the Boyle case cited in our briefs, has recognized the important role that returns play in tax administration, and that without widespread compliance with the requirement of self-assessment through a return, that we would not be able to have a workable tax system. And it, based on that reasoning, all three courts of appeals to address this issue previously have concluded that when the taxpayer waits until after tax has been assessed, after the burdensome process of figuring out his tax liability as that is completed, at that point, a form filed thereafter can't be an honest and reasonable attempt to comply with the law and therefore is not a return for purposes of Bankruptcy Code Section 523A1BI. And I think that that result is also very consistent with the policy concerns at play here. I think, first of all, this is not just a case where the principle that the debtor should get a fresh start should apply, as the courts below suggested, but rather we're dealing with a section of the Bankruptcy Code that specifically deals with preserving the government's right to collect taxes. And in that context, the Supreme Court has said that you don't focus on the fresh start concept of bankruptcy, but rather that concept's of a little help. And I think particularly since we're dealing with the tax law definition, bankruptcy context shouldn't come into play here, and that really the tax purpose of a return under the tax law should be the focus of the analysis as a policy matter. For all these reasons, I think that the rulings of this court's sister circuit should be followed here. Your Honor, one of the things that will result from an affirmance in this case really is that an absurd result would follow. To hold that this form filed without any excuse after the IRS has already gone through the process of determining tax liability and assessing would send a message that if you want to avoid your taxes, you should just file nothing at all, wait and see if you get caught, and at that point, you can just blob in this last-minute, useless piece of paper to the IRS and then get a discharge in bankruptcy. And as the Walsh Court put it, one of the many lower courts that have followed the three courts of appeals on this issue, that would defeat the independence of our tax system. And it also would mean the person who has the sense to remember to realize that they can benefit from submitting this belated piece of paper will obtain a benefit in bankruptcy that the more naive person who doesn't realize that does not. And as the Henning Lane Court put it, that would create a real inconsistency in our tax law.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Stonson. Mr. Miller?
Thank you. John Payne.
This is sort of an interesting case because John Payne attempted to square off his...
Well, I mean, that's absurd, right? He waits until he's assessed and files the return. That means the return has no utility. It's fraudulent filing, fraudulent returns, misrepresentation. The Judge Easterbrook mentioned, that's one misuse of a return. Filing it after you've been assessed is another, right?
If you put
the government to the bother of computing the tax and assessing the taxes, whereas if you filed a timely return, they could have proceeded in the normal course without trying to figure out what Payne's income was.
He filed 8 years of returns at the same time in an effort.
Well, terrific. Why didn't he file his returns when they were
legal? So you get no credit for trying to talk over and shout down the judge's questions.
Thank you, Your Honor. I apologize. I really do. I'm sorry.
Okay. I'm finished. My question is, why didn't he file the 8 years of returns when they were due? Why should we get an advantage in bankruptcy from horsing around the Internal Revenue Service like this?
His life was in crisis as the Internal Revenue Service knew because they took his deposition in the bankruptcy.
Your life can be in crisis. When you file a return, you explain, you can ask for an extension, so you file a return and say, I owe you X thousand, I don't have it, now I have to work something out. That's what honest people who get into trouble do. They have any taxable income, they owe taxes, but they can't pay them. So the IRS doesn't take their children away, right? We work something out for them.
In this case, Your Honor, he was doing work in a job that was terminating.
Look, I can also understand, he's about to fill out his return, he catches his hands in the disposal unit, so now he can't sign the return. I understand, too. Being in New York doesn't mean you can't file a return. It's extremely easy to file a return.
That's absolutely correct. However,
could you be
totally depressed?
Could you be perhaps concrete? I'm interested in what consequences attach to this being a return or not, and not just bankruptcy. In your view, what consequences did it have whether this document was properly returned when filed?
In order for him to make an offer in compromise, he had to file all his returns. The stipulation of facts in this case says that he filed all these returns with the purpose of making the offer in compromise.
Right. So what in the statute or regulations limits an offer in compromise to a case where a return has been filed?
In order to make the offer in compromise, the IRS demands that you have
all the returns. I'm asking for a citation. What in the statute of regulations requires this?
I can't give it to you, Your Honor.
Okay. You see, I can easily understand that if you want to compromise with the IRS and they won't talk compromise unless you file a return, that somebody files a document, and then I have to ask the IRS's lawyer whether they would consider compromise because in their view there's no return. But it would really help to know what the statutes and regulations say, and just talking in generalities doesn't really help.
I don't have that specific citation of the IRS regulations. The stipulation that this case went off on in the bankruptcy court, and the stipulated facts, said that he filed his returns for 82-21 without paying, that he filed the 86-1040, which he prepared and mailed to the IRS, and it was part of Payne's attempt to advise the IRS of his tax liability and effectuate an offer in compromise. He offered the IRS the first offer in compromise, $100,000. The second offer in compromise was $124,000, payably different. The third offer in compromise was $99,000 and change. With each offer in compromise, he sent the IRS $1,000. In the negotiation that he had with the IRS, he advised them, and this took over 3 years, this offer in compromise proceedings. He didn't just file his returns and then go bankrupt.
I don't understand. I don't understand this. You're saying anybody can play this game, right? And hope for a sympathetic judge.
That's not what I believe. That's
right. I mean, you don't pay your taxes. Then you submit belated returns, make a tiny deposit, and then you use the bankruptcy to wipe out your tax debt. Sounds like a scam.
That's what it was in Hatton, but it's not here, Judge. He offered $100,000 with the first offer in compromise. That was rejected. He offered $124,000 with the second. That was rejected. He offered $99,000 with the third.
Mr. Perhaps you would want to rely on statutes and regulations. It seems to me you would want to rely on Section 523A1B2.
I do, because that's what...
There is a bankruptcy rule dealing with the situation Judge Posner just mentioned. It's 523A1B2. It happens not to catch your client, because your client filed this document about 5 years before he filed for bankruptcy, and the statute deals only with people who file their returns within 2 years of bankruptcy.
That's correct, Your Honor.
So the IRS is asking for an extension of that time rule.
The IRS is attempting to engraft a rule in the bankruptcy code that Congress didn't do. And they didn't even do the rule that they just passed. They didn't address that issue at all. They did not say that when the IRS makes a determination of taxes for you, that bars you from filing the return number 523.
Well, they shouldn't bar you. I don't understand.
Because Congress didn't say it barred you. If Congress said it barred you, up until the mid-60s, you couldn't even file a bankruptcy that doesn't affect your income taxes. Then in the mid-60s, Congress passed different versions of the Bankruptcy Act, I believe, and that allowed a debtor who had taxes due for 3 years of income 3 years prior to the filing to discharge those taxes. And that's what the rules are today.
You're allowed to discharge your taxes if you owe them for more than 3 years.
I don't think that's what the statute says. Filed within 2 years of bankruptcy, you can't discharge, which means if you file your returns on time, you can discharge 3 years earlier. But if you don't file your returns on time, well, the discharge is going to be blocked.
That's not my reading of 523A1, and that's not the bulk of the courts that have interpreted reading of 523. If there's been a return has been filed, and 3 years go by, that those obligations under that tax return can be discharged. They didn't contest all the rest of the return's dischargeability. And the reason they didn't contest them is because they believed that Hinden Lang engrafted onto the bankruptcy code a further restriction that a discharge could not be granted if the government had made an assessment. And that's...
Well, they didn't think they received the 86 return. Isn't that why they made the assessment?
That was the first... Yes, that was the original assessment, yes. But in the context of this case, and after they made the offer in compromise, they entered into a stipulation in the bankruptcy court as to what happened. And that was that these...
What happened is that you didn't file a return on time. Wait until there was a tax assessment, the jig was up. Now filing a return doesn't do anything. There's no thing. If you hadn't filed a return, you could still make your offer and compromise and so on, right? The assessed fee is only a certain amount. So you say, all right, you think I owe, $20,000. So, all right, I'll give you 10, something like that. You don't need a return. Return doesn't add anything to your negotiations with the IRS.
In order to file an offer in compromise, you must, with the IRS, have all of your returns current.
They would really help if there was some statute or regulation backing up that assertion.
If I knew that question was coming, Your Honor, I certainly would have brought it in. But because the stipulation in the bankruptcy court that the government is attempting to overrule says that he attempted to advise the IRS of his tax liability and effectuate an offer of compromise, that's part of the record. Those are the facts that this case is based on. And that's
we seem to think there's some virtue in someone who has been caught not filing returns saying, oh, well, okay, I'm caught, you've caught me, now let's compromise. Right? I mean, what's the virtue in that? They could just say, look, we didn't compromise. We're going to squeeze every cent out of you.
There's no virtue in that, Judge. I pay my taxes current, as everybody else in this room does.
But how do you know everybody else does in this room? There'd be a bunch of people in the audience who thought, wow, this fellow Payne has quite a deal here. Let's think about that.
Payne's life was destroyed as a result of all of this.
So that's what we want to have trials about, people's lives destroyed.
His life was destroyed? Was he deported to Kazakhstan or something?
No, Judge.
But his life wasn't destroyed.
Was totally depressed. This was his divorce as a result of this. These were very difficult times for him. And the bankruptcy code's basic premise is give a fresh start under certain circumstances.
That is a goal of bankruptcy. Another goal is to provide, enable creditors to enforce their rights. That's part of bankruptcy, too.
Yes. And if the creditor's rights are determined by the code to be unenforceable, as they were in this case, they should be unenforceable. The discharge should be applicable to the IRS obligation. If the court has nothing further.
Okay, thank you very much, Mr. Mullen. So, Ms. Del Sol, I'm sorry to see you.
Taxes were assessed and the others were not, was because the IRS believed that it had not received an 86 return?
I don't have any evidence that that is correct, Your Honor. There were two reasons that the 86 taxes were assessed. First of all, because in the record, the IRS had information that those taxes had not, for an information return, that there was a tax liability for those years, and the fact that there was an information return for employer for 86 is what the record indicates triggered the IRS's investigation and ultimate assessment of the tax.
And you can see that
the IRS got the information return, assessed tax, and had already completed the task of assessment before the debtor came forward at all and filed anything for any of the years for which he hadn't filed returns. Then after that assessment occurred, when the IRS was already on his trail with collection and he started levying his wages, then he came forward and had an accountant submit returns.
I'm just trying to figure out why the 86 was singled out to be assessed.
The 86 was singled out because an information return had been filed that led the IRS to realize somehow in the computer system, but they got put together in the computer system and the IRS started the investigation process and had assessed before the debtor came forward with respect to any of the years. And at that point, the debtor had reason to know that the IRS was after him, that the IRS was putting pieces together and would probably be after him for another year soon. And the reason that the IRS went ahead and assessed is because it knew that the return had been filed for that year and had tracked that down through the information returns. And with respect to the other years, it hadn't gone through that process yet.
But the good point is he had never filed. He had never filed a return for 86 until after the assessment.
He
would be other people filing.
He had forms for other years, and his position was that there was an 86 return in there. The IRS records indicate there was not. But we've basically, we lost the issue of appeal, and we've not argued. I mean, we lost the issue of appeal.
That had nothing to do with how he was assessed on 86.
Right. Well, I mean, nothing to do with the fact that the 86 return wasn't in the package, according to the IRS. What it has to do with is the fact that for that year, we already went through the process of doing the investigation, tracking down the tax liability, and assessing before he came forward at all. And the reason the tax wasn't assessed for the other years was simply that by the time he came forward, the IRS hadn't gone through that process, hadn't gone through the burdensome.
Wait, now I'm confused. When did he file his 86 return?
He
Counsel, stop trying to shout down the court.
I apologize, Your Honor.
Your view is that he has never filed a return for 1986. That he did file a document that he purported to be a return.
To the extent that he did file something in 92, it is our position that he filed a document that is not a return because assessment had already occurred, and that's one too.
The original position was he didn't file a piece of paper, right?
If he filed anything, it was nothing more than a piece of paper that did not serve the purpose of a return.
When did you first file this piece of paper? I mean, it seems like the lost return.
In the court, the government argued that he had never filed anything at all with regard to 1986. And the court
said, I thought he filed something recently.
In 1992, the taxpayer's position was that he had.
Okay, so for purposes of appeal, you're conceding he did. But you're not conceding he filed a timely piece of paper. We're just talking. No, I understand. But this loss or the document, in any event, was filed in 92, not in 86.
Yeah,
I was confused. Okay.
And so it's her actions.
Right. The fact that the paper was lost and disappeared or whatever is not the reason that he was assessed on that for that year.
It was because the IRS had gotten the information return and had already assessed tax well before that. And at that point, when he submitted the package of forms in 1992, because the other years the IRS hadn't started the assessment process, they gave it the IRS information that made the returns to serve the purpose under the tax law.
I'd like you to address the question, the statement of Mr. Miller, that the reason this document, we will call it, was filed, was to facilitate an offer in compromise. What is the service's view about whether you can have an offer in compromise without the filing of a tax return?
My understanding, Your Honor, is that generally the service does not negotiate regarding offers in compromise unless a tax form has been filed. And I don't know, Your Honor, whether that arises just out of the policy of how they deal with these things because they want to have information to the greatest extent possible before they proceed, or whether there is a regulation. I could certainly find that out for the court and letter to the court answering that.
I would certainly like to know that if there's a statute or regulation on the point. Because, again, if one pursues the question of parity, if there is such a regulation, your position implies that once an assessment is made, there can be no compromise with the taxpayer. Even if the taxpayer then files a return, compromise is now impossible.
I think that what our position is that once tax has been assessed, it will virtually never be the case that the taxpayer has made an honest and reasonable attempt to comply with the law. It doesn't mean necessarily that the service will not negotiate a compromise.
Well,
and
that depends on whether, in the service's view, it is possible to have to go through this offer and compromise procedure without a document that the service is willing to call a return.
Well, I'm in Manhattan, Your Honor.
Look, off the top of your head is not going to be very helpful. Statutes and regulations will be helpful to me.
I would like to make just one last point. That in Hatton, the taxpayer didn't actually file a Form 1040. He simply came in and gave the information to the IRS in an informal way, and that was sufficient to proceed with compromise discussions. But I'll be happy to look up that question and send a letter to the court.
Okay. Well, thank you, Mr. Stone. Thank you, Mr. Stone.
I apologize.
That's okay. Next case for argument is